Okay. That was really, I think, an amazing, very powerful and very, very, very emotional. And we are privileged that Ethan Eisenberg, who made the film, you saw it, the producer, the director, the originator came up with the idea, is right here on my left. And we had the pleasure of his company, him and his wife. They are recently married in the summer. We'll give him a mazel tov. His wife is, we had them over Shabbos, and he will answer questions about the film, talk anything you want to know about the film. We'll do it that way. I think what we're going to do is we'll, if you have a question, you can line up. We'll ask, you know, 3-4 questions in a row, and then he can answer the questions in one shot. I'm sorry, okay. Or you can raise your hand. You'll also notice, of course, they mentioned the Miotzar HaRav series. We have a special order, I'm sure you noticed when you came in, of the writings of the Rav that after he passed away, all the manuscripts are putting in, they are available. They are at a big discount, trust me, from what you can get them at a store. So we have a limited number of them until they sell out. So after this, I'll let Ethan, you know, I'll let him comment maybe just for a couple minutes on the film. And Elliot will walk around if anybody has any questions. Where's the mic?
Hi, everybody. Hope you enjoy the film. Just wanted to mention, first of all, that the film took about, you're probably wondering this, so I'll just tell you. It took about a year and a half from the time we had funding until we completed the film. I actually ended up getting married a week later. That was planned. That wasn't a surprise. But so we had a pretty hard deadline. My wife's standing in the corner, and she just had her birthday a few days ago, so which my wife, Neely, happy birthday. But from conception, from the time that I first was discussing making the film until now, it was about 4 years ago, almost 4 years ago. I didn't actually come up with the original idea. That actually the credit has to go to Rabbi Aaron Rekef at Rothkopf, who wrote a book on Rabbi Soloveitchik called The World. I think it's called The Rav, The World of Rabbi Joseph B. Soloveitchik. It's mostly a collection from the Rav's lectures. Rabbi Rekef had spent years listening to a lot of these lectures on audio tape, and he took a few of the Rav's essays too and some secondhand stories, and he basically categorized them. And he basically called a lot of lectures for personal biographical material, as well as material that described the Rav's opinion on things, and put that together in different sections. So I recommend, we're not selling the book now, but if you're interested in buying that, to look into that. And Robert Kefet also spent, he spends years lecturing on Rabbi Soloveitchik, and you can listen to a lot of his audio recordings at yutorah.org. Anyways, so it was his idea, and he was looking for somebody to make the film, and somebody got me in touch with him, and that's how the entire thing started. And the more I read about Rabbi Soloveitchik, the more I was fascinated about his biography and about his the way that his biography and his thought and a lot of the themes that he stressed over and over again, the way that they were really fully integrated. And it's a very dramatic story. So I set about making the film. So if people have more questions about that, I can tell them. And other than that, I just wanted to remind all of you, if you want to hear more about the film and when it's coming out into theaters and when it's coming out on DVD, to go onto the website, lonelymanoffaith.org, .com, sign on to the website. And there's a list of screenings, so you can find out more information about that. Okay, so if anybody has any questions.
I'm going to be taking the mic around if anybody has any questions. I'm actually going to lead off with one.
Go ahead.
And just a comment beforehand. In tomorrow's panel, we're going to deal with a number of the themes and issues that came up in this film, the Rav's attitude to secular studies, his Zionism, his loneliness, issues of the revisionism, issues of his relationship with the ultra-Orthodox world. So a lot of that will be fleshed out with Rabbi Carmi and Dr. Schatz and Dr. Lustiger. And so my first question actually was, you have a lot of people who are interviewed in this film who are all, in a certain sense, in one community. I was wondering if you had attempted to elicit response from the more ultra-Orthodox community in terms of going on camera and talking about the Rav, and whether you tried that and what the response was.
Sure. Before I respond to that, I just wanted to make a point. I don't know if you noticed on the credits, I had a panel, I had a group of, I think something like five advisors, from my official advisors, people who I went to time and again when making the film, and some of the people reviewed the script. We had a mini conference before we even put the script together, where I had a treatment I had written, which lays out a lot of the film. We had them comment on that, and we had a mini conference where we had sort of what you're doing tomorrow with the panel, where we asked them questions and everybody weighed in. So several of the people on the panel are the people who are coming tomorrow. Rabbi Karmi, who was not only on the panel but was interviewed, Dr. Schatz, who wasn't able to be interviewed but was gave me constant advice throughout the film. So they were involved. Rav Schechter, who's in town and who's speaking tomorrow, you saw was interviewed. And Dr. Lustiger was not directly involved in the film, but I did speak to him at one point, and he gave me some advice as well. He's also, first time he met the Rav was at my alma mater, it was at University of Pennsylvania. The Rav was brought in to give lectures to a few colleges, and Penn was one of them. And that lecture was actually published later. So he heard him speak there first and then got very interested in hearing more. So in terms of that question, my original conception was I was going to present sort of different faces of Rabbi Soloveitchik. That wasn't going to be the only thing in the film, but I really wanted to provide different perspectives on the Rav and have a lot of the arguments over who the Rav was and pick a few incidents and show how different people look at it differently. So we have, for instance, Rabbi Saul Berman, who you might consider to be a more liberal Orthodox figure, while Rabbi Albert Braunschweigel, you can make the case is a more conservative Orthodox figure, conservative of the small c. So Rabbi Albert Braunschweigel does appear in the film. Unfortunately, he only made it for one line. But I asked questions that would elicit different responses. And in the end, we just decided that, you know, we'd rather concentrate on the Rav's life rather than on what his students think about him. And we knew that concentrating on all the controversies could sort of overwhelm the project, and that could become the main focus. Hopefully, I'm going to come out with the film on DVD eventually, and I hope that I'll be able to add a disc or two of extra features, not only like, you know, a behind-the-scenes sort of thing, but really getting into some of the issues deeper, so some of the controversies, as well as expanding the Rav's way of learning, his Derech HaLimud, some of his philosophical ideas, and some biographical details and historical information that we didn't get a chance to flesh out fully. We did one interview on Interfaith Dialogue, by the way, with Reuven Kimmelman, who appears at the end. It was an entire interview on Vatican II and Interfaith Dialogue, and we got into it from all different perspectives, and we put together a really nice scene, and then in the end we just said that the film's too long, so we had to cut it out. So that's an example of something that we'll be able to get into more. But yeah, actually, to answer your question, also, I spoke with several candidates who was going to be my more right-wing, you know, view on the Rav. Several of the people basically refused, a few refused to talk to me. Some did talk to me, but they refused to participate unless they got to see the script and approve of everything in the film. And obviously I wasn't going to do that. And then there was at least one person who is a very intellectually honest person who, you know, is firmly entrenched in the right wing but doesn't pretend like, oh, well, the Rav didn't really believe in secular studies. And he was honest. He said it. Clearly he was. But he had a very different take on Rabbi Soloveitchik that I thought was very unique and interesting. And sad enough, he didn't want to participate because he felt that his friends on the right would basically be angry at him for saying nice things about Rabbi Soloveitchik. And his friends who are more YU would be angry at him for criticizing Rabbi Soloveitchik. He didn't want to lose his friends. So he says to me, if I participate, I'll lose my friends. So I didn't have a good counter argument to that. Oh, come on. Who needs friends? So, you know, I respected that, and I just said, okay.
Firstly, thank you. I thought it was a terrific job, and I really enjoyed it. I felt like I was in the presence of greatness. I never got to actually hear the Rav, but I really got a sense of him. I noted that the only family member was Rav Lichtenstein, no grandchildren, no daughters, etc., no son. Was there an attempt made to elicit their views? And I'll leave it to you to answer.
I've shown the film four times now, and I've always been asked that question. So my wife said I should actually just open up answering that question before anybody asks. I approached all three of the Rubs' children, and I informed them about the film. I didn't ask for permission. It wasn't an issue where I asked for permission. Actually, I heard that somebody mistakenly reported to one of the children that I had claimed previously that I asked permission. It just wasn't an issue where it was a permission issue. But I felt that it was something that they should be informed about. That was the appropriate thing to do. And all three of them made it clear that they didn't want to be involved, each in their own unique way. So I was respectful, and my job was to keep respectful distance. And I kept the door open, so if any of them decided that they wanted to be involved in some way, wanted to be interviewed, then I would completely welcome that. I wasn't trying to block anybody out, but they didn't want to. But in the end, Rev Lichtenstein consented to be interviewed, so that was great. You know, I didn't. To be honest, I wasn't sure that would happen. I didn't expect that would happen. So, grandchildren, one grandchild I had asked if the person wanted to be involved, and the person did not. The other ones, in the end, we just had to limit the number of people we could interview. So, and since some of them are in Israel, that presented a tactical problem too. We interviewed Rav Lichtenstein when he was here last November, actually, for I think it was the Yeshiva conference, or he was in for the Orthodox Forum. He was in New York, so we arranged an interview there. But you know, we interviewed 25 people. Only 22 made it into the film. And every time you interview somebody, it's very costly and time consuming. So we had to limit the number of people we interviewed. And that's something I learned along the way. I would have interviewed 25 more people, and then my editor would have been very angry because he had to, you know, cut those people out.
One sec, we're doing in order. Hang on.
The family hasn't seen the film yet, to my knowledge.
Yeah, go ahead.
Did the Rav ever give a specific reason why he turned down the opportunity to become a Rav Rashi in Israel?
You're saying the chief rabbi of Israel. Well, actually, there's an interesting incident that didn't have a chance to make it into the film. In 1935, Rabbi Soloveitchik had only been in Boston for 3 years, and he really had not yet found his place. Remember, his father had groomed him to be the next Gadol Lador. And his father sent letters to people in America and elsewhere saying, you know, basically, this is the Gadol Lador. Halacha is like him in all matters. So he hits the ground running, and he finds a community that's somewhat assimilated and not necessarily interested in turning him into the chief rabbi. And so for the first 10 years, he really did not feel like he found his place, and there's evidence that he was looking for other positions. The chief rabbi of Tel Aviv opened up. In 1935, it was still Palestine. It wasn't Israel yet. And he went to Israel that summer, and he campaigned. He was running against Rav Herzog and Rav Amiel from Belgium, from Antwerp, and he lost. Not only did he lose, but there's evidence that he came away from the experience very disappointed and upset. In terms of Israel, the chief rabbi of Israel, the reasons he gives, actually, one of the best books you can buy if you're interested in hearing more from the Rav directly is the third or fourth volume of the Torah to Rav Foundation that's being sold outside, called Covenant, Commitment, and Community, not necessarily in that order. It's a book of letters and interviews with Rabbi Soloveitchik, and there's a massive section on Zionism, and a lot of it is about the chief rabbinate of Israel. He wrote a lot of letters to people explaining why he didn't want it. The main thing, it seemed to me, was that he didn't want to be an instrument of the government. If there's anything you understand about Rabbi Soloveitchik, he likes being independent. He doesn't like anybody telling him what to do. And he feels that the rabbinate and religion really should be independent of government, of politics. And his sense was that in Israel, and you know, you can decide yourselves whether this is still the case, that the Knesset had a certain amount of control over the chief rabbinate, and the chief rabbi was not free fully to do what he wanted. Actually, side point, the chief rabbinate was also not fully free of the National Religious Party, of Mafdal. And they too, there's evidence that he wasn't fully going to have their support. There are different reports. Some say that he had it on a silver platter, and if he wanted it, he could get it. There were also indications that he wasn't necessarily going to get it either. And there were people within his own party, within Mizrahi, who felt like the theory is that they felt that the Rav was going to be too much of a loose cannon. They weren't going to be able to tell him what to do. Now, the Rav had lectured at Mizrahi conventions from the time he became honorary chairman in the 50s until his death, until he stopped giving lectures. And you read some of the lectures, the Rav speaks as a collection. It was originally called the Chamesh Drashot, the Four Drashot, five drashot he gave. And, you know, can you imagine an organization putting up the honorary president, and he spends half the time lashing out at the organization? That was Rav. So he would talk about that he would attack the government in Israel and what they're doing about this issue, that issue. He would be very supportive of Zionism and the idea of a government in Israel, but there were certain things he attacked them at, and he would attack his own party. So the people in Mizrahi were not so excited about the idea of him being the chief rabbi and the idea that that would happen. So that's one reason he gives. But we were going to spend a lot of time about this in the film. There are indications that the Rav himself was not interested necessarily in moving to Israel and in visiting Israel again. And there's a whole sort of debate that goes on about how serious was he about moving back to Israel and about being chief rabbi of Israel. Some say he wasn't really serious. But in one of the letters, and that's where I took my cue, he said that he had dreams about what he was going to do as chief rabbi. He was going to change education in Israel. He was going to reform the entire institution of the rabbinate, and that ultimately he realized his dreams would not be able to be realized. So I took that cue, since it's also dramatic, I took that cue in my film, but ultimately whether I'm right or not, I don't know. Many people say that when the Rav would write things or say things, he didn't always mean exactly what he said. And some say that might be disingenuous to not take him at his word, but you know, we all know that people are more complicated than their mere statements, so I can't ultimately give the answer to that. There's probably more information you wanted to know. Yes?
At the end of the film, you mentioned the fact that different people who hear him will come up with different interpretations, even people sitting in the same lecture. And yet in the body of the film, you do make pronouncements are made, for instance, on the position of his view on women in Jewish education. How did you feel comfortable coming to these statements that sort of sounded like pronouncements where you also at the end talk about this vast difference of opinion on the same topics that the Rev would talk about?
That's a good question. It was a very difficult process for me. A lot of things that seemed simple in the film, there was a lot of research and a lot of conversations behind it and a lot of thinking and sleepless nights over how exactly I was going to phrase things. And I would have people I would show a statement to, and they'd say, that's not exactly accurate. This word or that word might be wrong, and I'd have to rephrase it. When it came to education for women, it really seems from the people I spoke to clear that he felt very strongly that women should be educated to the same degree as men. Now, he didn't have a shir that he taught at the yeshiva for women like he did for men. It wasn't like YU had the same program for women than for men. So it's not clear that he would go that far, but at Maimonides school, which the curriculum of Maimonides, at least the Torah curriculum, was approved by him. He set the curriculum. And they made it a point to teach women exactly what they taught the men. They were coeducation. Now, there's a controversy over whether the Rav believed in coeducation or not, and I was actually very careful, and when Rabbi Schachter spoke, I think he was very careful not to make it sound like the Rav Lechachila, to begin with, was pro-coeducation 100% because as an educational ideal. Now, there are many who say he was, and there are many who say he wasn't. So I decided not to take a stance on that. But what seemed clear is that the coeducation at Maimonides was a function of equal education. They believed most strongly in equal education. Now, don't get me wrong, there are those who debate that, but I think those who were closest to the Rav felt that this was the case. Tara Tursky, the Rav's daughter, made it a point of saying in the school that the Rav felt very strongly that separate is not equal. Now, many have asked, so then how does that then translate into mechitza? When it comes to prayer, how do you deal with that? So my answer is that's a halachic issue. And can I explain it philosophically as well? Maybe not. My writer, who is not Orthodox, felt that there was a disparity. And when I gave the Rav's philosophy, the way the Rav explained it is that, you know, prayer is about man standing lonely before God, and really, if you have mixed seating, then you won't be lonely before God, you'll be with other people. So he said, so why don't you just pray alone? Now, you know, sometimes you can't explain everything philosophically. There are halachic reasons behind it, and I believe in the halachic system. I'm not attacking the idea of a separate prayer. But in terms of learning, specifically though, it was very clear that he felt very strongly about that. Now you might ask the question: if his two oldest kids were not girls, and there was already a good school where girls could get a good education, would he have insisted upon there being a school with co-education? I don't know. And would he say today that classes should be co-ed or classes should be separate? I don't know. In other words, if he felt that there are schools today where women get the same education as men, then maybe he wouldn't have been, but maybe he would. I can't take a stance on it. But I know it's a hot issue in a lot of communities. But what we're saying is not a practical and legal decision today, but he felt very strongly at the time and throughout his life that women should get the same education as men. And people who were close to him at the time that he taught that class at Stern, that he taught the first class at Stern, said that it was clear that he was making a statement. He said to people, I want to teach this first class because I want to make it clear that I'm okay with it. There were those who had problems with it, and he came out and he wanted to make it clear which side he stood.
You mentioned the origin of the movie came from one of the rabbis that spoke in the movie. Has making the movie changed you in some way?
That's a good question. Well, before I made the movie, I was single, and now I'm married. That's definitely changed me. It's changed me in the sense that I think I haven't changed in terms of my allegiance to tradition. It's not like I was less observant before and I'm more observant now or vice versa. But it has given me, it definitely has introduced me, has enriched my understanding of our tradition, enriched my understanding of not only of Jewish law, but of Jewish thought. I've learned a lot about Jewish history in the terms of making the film. I asked a lot of questions, what's historically significant, what's not. And every single detail in the film I had to get background on. It was a very enriching education, but it was a very, difficult because I had to self-teach myself constantly. And before I could speak to any of the people who are experts on philosophy, I had to do a background on everything that the Rav had written. So in that sense, I think it is enriched me, and it's obviously given me a feeling like if I can make a film like this, it's given me hopes for my future. I think there's one in the back.
Okay. So we at Torah Motion are really proud that we could show this film to you. We urge and hope for everyone to come tomorrow to our conference. And, we're going to wrap up. And we hope to see you tomorrow. And please give Mr. Eisenberg a big hand. Okay.